You're listening to From the Pulpit by Sahlein. If you enjoy this podcast, please consider becoming our patron by donating at sahlein.org/support.
The fact that we now see people diverging and becoming distant from religion is very similar to what Imam Sajjad alayhi salam experienced in his imam. This sense of moral degradation. The fact that people are leaving religion or at least becoming disinterested or uninterested in practicing their faith. These are all things that Imam Sajjad experienced. He witnessed all of this. This is nothing new. Obviously, we know that religion, just like the economy, just like every other thing in this life, is cyclical. It goes through cycles. There are ups and downs in the chart. What we're experiencing today is a downward cycle, very similar to the time of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. Which is why, if we're going to face these challenges today, we need to study the life of Imam Zain al-Abidin and the context in which the Imam operated in order to address the challenges we find in the contemporary world. So again, keep this in mind. If we were going to pick an Imam who was going to provide us with answers to these questions, it would be Imam Sajjad. Because his time, his era, his period was marred by moral degradation, by people feeling disconnected from religion. There was a sense of hopelessness. There was an economic uptick at the time, which made a lot of people very wealthy. And so all of these things contributed to a society that was anything but religious. In spite of the fact, as we said, that mosques were always full. People prayed. They practiced religion out in the open. But in reality, there was an incident narrated in books such as Tariq al-Tabari and others, that a concert was held. Obviously, now we call it a concert. Back then, it was just a singer coming to town. A concert was held in Basra, and the youth of Medina traveled from Medina to Basra in order to attend the concert. Imagine, this is barely 50, 60 years after Rasulullah. And people would travel these vast distances just so they could watch someone sing. A woman, no less. Things were so bad at one point that they would bring slaves to sell in the open market. And by the way, the slave trade flourished after the first three Khulafa. And the reason for that was because of all the conquests. They called it jihad, or as the scholars refer to it as jihad ibtida'i, which is when you initiate a war, a conquest against a neighboring country or region or tribe. They called it jihad because they had to put a religious facade over it. Otherwise, it was very simply a means of acquiring the wealth of that country. They were not interested in spreading Islam by any means. And so this quote-unquote jihad was a means of conquest and occupation. Of course, a byproduct of that, we're trying to improve the country's economic situation. We have poverty, for example. People are becoming, they're growing resentful towards their public officials, the Khalifa and his family, especially during the time of Uthman. Everyone knows that the family, those closest to him, became wealthy overnight. They were seen around in public. Like, imagine now if you see somebody driving a Lamborghini, how do you feel about that? The first question you ask is, look, I knew this guy before. He was not wealthy. He doesn't come from a wealthy family. What happened? How did he get his money? Back then, imagine suddenly you had the wives of Rasulullah, as you do today when you have like a public official, there are motorcades, right? You see many, many cars and security guards and whatnot to make sure that this convoy is safe. But part of it is the spectacle. Part of it is the idea that I'm not a regular person. I'm not your average Joe. I'm someone who's special. I'm somehow related to Rasulullah. And so a wife of Rasulullah would walk around with a convoy of camels and 200 people. So this materialism began to take shape, with money being brought in from the conquests, with people becoming wealthier and more affluent. What happens? People turn to entertainment. They want joy, they want pleasure, and they'll do anything to get it. Because again, imagine traveling from Medina to Basra is a trip, a journey that takes months. And so for someone to do that means that they'd have to have the means. They'd have to have the wealth. They'd have to have essentially a great degree of boredom. In other words, these people weren't working. They didn't have a 9-to-5. They just had a lot of money that they felt they should spend in order to acquire as much pleasure as possible. Then comes Imam al-Sajjad, alayhi salatu wassalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ajal faraja. And he's dealing with a number of different things. On the one hand, there's a tyrannical regime that is in power, starting with Yazid himself. The Imam does not follow the path that was chosen by his father, Imam al-Hussein, because he was commanded not to. At-Tariq. This is in the hadith known as the hadith of Lawh, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala provides specific instructions to each of the imams. The one that pertains to Imam al-Sajjad contains this commandment from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. At-tariq wasmut wa'bud rabbaka hatta ya'tiyaka al-yaqeen. Lower your head, be quiet, and worship your Lord until death comes, until you depart this world. The Imam had to follow this strategy in order to address these problems. The first one, as I said, the most despotic, the most tyrannical, the most vicious individuals at the helm of the government, starting with Yazid, then Marwan, then Abd al-Malik ibn Marwan, then a series of individuals, each one of them, by the way. Marwan himself only ruled for about a year, but then his son ruled for 10 years, and his son after that ruled for another 10 years. So you can imagine about 25 years or more, Bani Marwan are in charge. The Imam has to deal with that. At a time when the Imam's every movement was being scrutinized, they would literally go to Medina seeking to arrest the Imam. Imam al-Sajjad had to live out in the desert like a Bedouin in order to safeguard himself and his family and to continue the mission. Imagine living out there in the desert, in tents. So that's one of the major challenges the Imam was faced with. The other challenge was the social, moral pandemic that had plagued society back then. The fact that people are simply not interested in religion anymore. And so how does the Imam bring them back into the fold? How does he educate them? How does he train them? He does so through his worship. In other words, he led by example. Instead of preaching to them, because again, remember, the Imam was not even known publicly. And I'll get to that point a little later. The Imam did not have any status or position in society, let alone politics. People didn't recognize him. In fact, hadith say that Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam would go to Hajj every year, and he would go with a group that doesn't recognize him. لا يعرفون. How would someone not know Ali ibn al-Husayn, Zain al-Abideen? But this tells you that people in those times simply didn't recognize him. The Imam kept his head low. In fact, I'll mention this hadith because it's interesting. So the Imam went with a caravan or a group that didn't recognize him. And the reason for that is because he would make a condition. He would stipulate that I will join you if you let me serve you. So he would simply serve the Hujjaj. And the hadith says, this is by Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. He says that the Imam would join them and he would just be like another servant. If somebody wants water, he'll bring him water. If someone wants food, if someone needs to carry some luggage around. So much so that at one point, someone recognized the Imam. He was from another group. He came, he noticed him. So he went to the group that the Imam was traveling with. And he said to them, do you know who this is? Who carries your luggage for you? Who cleans up after you eat your food? This is Zain al-Abideen, Ali ibn al-Husayn. So they came to him and apologized. They said to him, we didn't know who you were. We wish you had told us. So the Imam said to him, no, I would never tell you, because the last time I went with a group, with a caravan, and they recognized me, أعطوني برسول الله ما لا أستحق. They treated me in such a manner that because of my connection, because of my relationship with the Holy Prophet, they gave me a special treatment. And I don't deserve that. Even though the Imam deserves everything there is to give. And yet, his humility is such that he says, I don't want to be given any special treatment because of my ancestry that traces its way back to Rasulullah. So leave me. Allow me to serve you. Allow me to just be with you and spend time without you rolling the red carpet for me. The Imam was dealing with this issue, which is that on the one hand, he's targeted by the regime. On the other hand, people don't even recognize him. So who's going to help him? So what he does is he leads by example. We don't have any, as far as I can tell anyway, there's not a single report that anyone came to Imam al-Sajjad and asked him for a fatwa, asked him a question that has to do with jurisprudence. Imagine. We don't have any incident where people would pray behind Imam Zain al-Abidin. So he's not even recognized or acknowledged as a leader of Salat al-Jama'ah. So the Imam, instead of preaching to them, he led by example. He gave them treasures, priceless gems of wisdom. I was reading the Confessions of Saint Augustine. I don't know if you're familiar with the book, but Saint Augustine, a very influential figure in Christianity and Catholicism, he has a book called The Confessions. And it's basically an autobiography, but also it's a book of prayers and supplications. I would read this and then go back to skimming through As-Sahifa As-Sajjadiyya and think to myself, we have not shown any appreciation to the treasures that have been passed down to us from Imam As-Sajjad. Had the world been exposed to the Sahifa of Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam, the world would be a completely different place. Atheism, agnosticism, this complete moral degradation would not exist the way it does if people were exposed to the teachings and supplications of Imam al-Sajjad. I've read the Psalms of David, right? It's an annex to the Bible. You have the Old Testament, the New Testament, and you have the Psalms. Read the Psalms of David, take a quick look. Part of which, we have no doubt, was revealed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But it was revealed to a different community. It was revealed to people with limited mental capacities. Then come and read what Imam al-Sajjad has given us and gifted us. It is tragic and heartbreaking, to say the very least, that we are still the Sahifa itself is foreign to us. We have yet to discover what the Sahifa can offer. There are moral teachings. There are theological discussions. I mean, Dua Abu Hamza alone, that we read in the holy month of Ramadan. Notice how the Imam speaks to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the way he addresses the creator of the universe. How everything subtly falls into place and you recognize your inherent and intrinsic weakness and poverty just by reading these lines. And he's not teaching you anything new. He's just reminding you of the fact that we are nothing but creatures that were brought into existence by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and our need and poverty to the Creator is absolutely intrinsic. You read a dua like that and there's no room for hubris or arrogance because you realize who you really are. In the Sahifa, which I won't talk about tonight, inshallah we'll have more time to discuss it later, but you have a hadith about praying for your neighbor, for example, praying for your parents, your children. You have a hadith that highlight the role and significance and position of the Ahlul Bayt and God's vicegerents. Du'as that highlight this. You have du'as that curse the tyrants and enemies of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Again, this whole discussion about cursing, is this allowed? Is this not allowed? Read Sahifa Sajjadi and you'll see. You even have prayers that protect you against black magic and negative interference by the jinn and things like that. Just the other day, someone sent me a message saying that my child, my infant, has some kind of, I think she mentioned lactose intolerance, something like that. Now, for an infant, lactose intolerance is not good. And because the child, the infant survives on his mother's milk. So she said that my in-laws are saying that we should go and get a talisman from a peer in some Sufi shrine in Pakistan. And they're forcing me to do this. They're saying that if you don't follow the teachings of the peer, which is like, you know, the sage, if you don't follow his teachings, if you don't believe in him, then you don't believe in the miracles of the Ahlul Bayt. I said, how did you go from A to B? If you don't believe any fraudster, any charlatan who says that I can do something to alleviate your problem or to address your issues, then you don't believe in God or the Prophet or the Ahlul Bayt? I said, absolutely don't go anywhere near that. We have du'as in Sahifa Sajjadiya. Read those. This is the right way to approach things. And what a terrible situation we're in right now. Whether it be in countries like Iraq, there's a pandemic of black magic. It is absolutely disgusting how many people resort to these tactics. Black magic of all different kinds and types being used. A woman who has a problem with her husband tries a few of these tricks, and the hope, what she's been promised, is that your husband will love you again. And vice versa. Any issue that we face, suddenly the first person we think of is this old lady who reads a cup, or she can write something and give me a talisman, give me some kind of cure. If we believe that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala perfected his religion and completed his message, and if we believe when Rasulullah said, إِنِّي تَارِكُمْ فِيكُمُ الثَّقَلَيْنِ كِتَابَ اللَّهِ وَعِطْرَةِ أَهْلَ بَيْتِي مَا إِن تَمَسَّكْتُمْ بِهِمَا لَن تَظِلُّوا بَعْدِي أَبَدًا وَقَدْ نَبَّأَنِي اللَّطِيفُ الْخَبِيرُ أَنَّهُمَا لَا يَفْتَرِقَا حَتَّى يَرِدَا عَلَيَّ الْحَوْضُ. He's given you the full formula. Rasulullah has given us everything we need. The Quran and the Ahlul Bayt. Read the Quran. Try and understand it. Try and apply it. Follow the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. And you have nothing to worry about. Black magic. It's an entire industry that's been built to exploit vulnerable people who are in need and who are less intelligent than average, unfortunately, I'd have to say. Exploiting them, using them, and giving them the wrong medicine. Imagine someone who has cancer and you tell them that your medicine is to drink salt water from somewhere. It not only is it disingenuous and dishonest and wrong and immoral, but it won't solve the problem. You're misdiagnosing the problem, let alone giving them the right medications and medical instructions. Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam provides du'as to address this. And so the Imam leads by example, such that he becomes Zainul Abidin. The hadith, again, I believe it's by Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, says that one day Shaytan said to God, he said to him, you should allow me to deceive not just your regular people, but also the best of the best. I should have, it's only fair, I should have the chance, I should have a go with these individuals. And it's a challenge that I'm happy to take. So I'm summarizing. He comes to Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. The hadith says that he tried to scare the Imam at first. He came to him in the form of a snake that had 10 heads. He tried to bite the Imam. The Imam was in prayer. The Imam did not even bat an eye. Not a blink. Nothing. He kept his eyes focused on the turba, his place of prostration, and continued to pray. So the hadith says, Shaytan tried different tricks. As I said, he tried to bite the Imam's fingers. So he did a number of things, and the Imam would not give him any attention. Eventually, he stood next to the Imam, as the Imam was still in prayer. He said to him, Wallah, Shaytan, while he rejects the authority of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he doesn't reject his existence, and he knows God's majesty and glory. So the hadith says that he said to the Imam, Wallah, by God, I have met the most devoted worshippers, min Adam famadun. I have seen them all, I have experiences with them. فَلَمْ أَرَ أَحَدًا مِثْلَكَ I've never seen anyone like you. فَأَنْتَ حَقًّا زَيْنُ الْعَابِدِينَ You are truly the ornament of the worshippers. The worshippers, meaning God's prophets, messengers, the Ahlul Bayt, the Imam is an ornament for them. He's a means of beautification for them, not me and people like me. زَيْنُ الْعَابِدِينَ And so this name was given to the Imam by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Anta zaynu al-abideen. So the Imam led by example. The Imam led with worship and prayer, which unfortunately, again, a sign of our times is that worship is seasonal. It is transient. It is just a box we need to tick on the list of daily chores that we have. And this is for the most religious of us. Those who don't pray, those who don't practice, those who don't recite du'as, probably comprise the vast majority of people. But the religious ones treat acts of worship as just another box. Needs to be ticked, has to be done. I have to pray. Whereas Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, كان يصلي في اليوم والليلة ألف ركعة. It's easier said than done, much easier. 1,000 units of prayer per day. And it's not for lack of something to keep him occupied. The Imam had a family. The Imam would conduct charitable work. The Imam would carry food and deliver it to those most in need. The Imam would spend time with his servants and train them and discipline them and provide them with the education they need to go on and become sages of themselves. The Imam had a full roster, a full schedule. And yet, to squeeze in another 1,000 units of prayer, which is why among all of the members of the Ahlul Bayt, the one who's been likened to Amir al-Mu'mineen is Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. كان أشبه الناس بأمير المؤمنين. Other members of the Ahlul Bayt, Imam al-Husayn, for example, did resemble Rasulullah. Did resemble Amir al-Mu'mineen, but in certain aspects. Whereas Imam al-Hasan also, traditions tell us that he looked like Rasulullah from the waist up, right? You have others who have similarities, but the one with the greatest resemblance to Amir al-Mu'mineen was Imam al-Sajjad. Led by example, taught whenever he had the chance, and tried to completely upend the situation in his time. Which is why Sayyid Ja'far Murtada al-Amili has a book about the Imam. And the title of the book is this: Ali ibn al-Husayn Zainul Abidin Ba'athul Islam min Jadid. He's the one who revived Islam, brought it back to life, resuscitated the teachings of this religion which had been forgotten and destroyed. The Khulafa being complete savages and the most immoral people on the face of the planet, on the one hand, people trying to imitate their political leaders, as is always the case. An-nas ashbah ila mulukihim minhum ila abaihim. So when you have a corrupt government, what happens? At the bottom of the pyramid, people try to resemble. In some countries, I don't know if you've noticed, people even try to make their appearance resemble their leader. This emir or this sheikh or this malik, even the way they groom their beards, they try to emulate him. They try to imitate him. That's how it is. And so in a society that's like this, from the top down, from the bottom up, it's nothing but corruption, Imam al-Sajjad comes along. And he trains the likes of Abu Khalid al-Kabuli, Sa'id ibn Jubayr, and others, Abu Hamza al-Thumali, and he provides them with a blueprint to follow and reach the highest summits of servitude to Allah, devotion to Allah, which is the very core of Islam. The Imam does that in spite of all of these challenges.